In Artworks, the story of how a precious collection of ancient artefacts was stolen and trashed.
Like watching looters take treasures from King Tut's tomb, akin to the Taliban's destruction of the Bamiyan Buddhas. They're two of the reactions from alarmed international archaeological experts in the face of the tragedy of the ransacking of the National Museum of Iraq and the burning of the National Library in Baghdad.
People do anything they want.
Are we likely to see these treasures again? What will happen to them?
It really is going to depend on who's got them.
This is ABC Radio National, Amanda Smith with you. Now, we all remember the reasons why the US and allies invaded Iraq in 2003. It was to get rid of the vast stockpile of weapons of mass destruction, and it was to bring about regime change. But in the vacuum that was created over the days and weeks following the invasion, massive looting broke out in Baghdad. Schools and hospitals and government offices were all ransacked, but the most systematic and well-organised looting was at the National Museum of Iraq. As we watched the statue of Saddam Hussein topple over, the ransacking of the museum was already underway. More than 15,000 artefacts vanished onto the black market, and no one, it seems, lifted a finger to stop it.
Scholars and archaeologists around the world are mourning the loss of thousands of objects from Iraq's National Museum and thousands of books and documents in the National Library.
Artefacts, including tablets, telling the origin of writing, counting and mathematics, even the invention of the wheel.
Experts did warn the US before the war about the potential for theft, and they say they were assured that artefacts would be protected. But even now it seems that the only major government facility in Baghdad that has US military protection is the oil ministry, which remains untouched by looters.
Professor Potts says nothing will stop the dealers and buyers who are desperate to own some of the world's most ancient artefacts.
This is the treasure of 7,000 years of civilization. What does the country think it's doing?
As museum staff chase away the last of the looters, the cost to humanity is counted.
This is probably the single event from the current Gulf War that'll be remembered in the future. Long after all the other details are forgotten, the Iraqi people will remember this as the moment that their past disappeared.
The Iraqis may well remember, but around the world, a short media attention span combined with our own disaster fatigue means that by now the sacking of the Baghdad Museum is pretty largely forgotten. As the violence continues in Iraq, though, and 7 years now after the start of the conflict and the lootings, there are people outside of the country who are trying hard not to forget. Lawrence Rothfield is a former director of the Cultural Policy Centre at the University of Chicago, and he's the author of a book called The Rape of Mesopotamia, a detailed study of the episode that robbed us of the evidence of the beginnings of civilization. In this Artworks feature, he's in conversation with Michael Gurr.
Lawrence Rothfield, welcome to Artworks.
Thank you.
When I think of Iraq, I think of roadside bombs, I think of frightened people trying to vote in elections, I think of Fallujah and what happened there, I think of numberless destroyed Iraqi and American families, and history tells us again and again that the poor are always sent to fight the wars of the rich and the greedy and the stupid. So tell me, convince me, why does the collection of the Iraq National Museum matter?
The Iraq National Museum is the repository, the world's greatest repository of the remainders of the first great civilizations in world history. This is the place where writing was invented. This is the place where irrigation was invented. This is the place where the first empires were formed. So we have a lot to learn from the experiences there.
And your book is called The Rape of Mesopotamia. So just give me a really quick little history and geography lesson. Mesopotamia, is that the rough equivalent of today's Iraq, or was it bigger?
It roughly overlaps with today's Iraq. It's the area between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, which have shifted over time, but centrally in Iraq, yes.
And this phrase keeps coming up, the cradle of civilization. What does that actually mean?
Well, it means that until the Sumerians banded together, forming larger units than the small settlements that had existed before then, there were no real cities on the earth. So it's really the beginning of an organized society with religion playing a central role, kingship, and bureaucracies and so forth. And so a relatively organized way of life that wherein nature was controlled through irrigation and so forth.
And the museum is the repository. It's the sort of record of all that.
Yes. And if you actually go to Iraq and go out into the desert, you look around, you'll see gently undulating little hillocks. And these actually, there are maybe 50 to 100,000 of these. These are the original settlements. And then at a certain point, people realized they didn't have to live 5,000 yards apart from each other or a couple of miles apart, and they started agglomerating into cities.
Okay, so prior to the invasion in 2003, I'm out for an afternoon stroll in Baghdad. I think I'll take in the museum. What do I see there?
Well, at the museum, if you had gone after 1991, you wouldn't have been able to get in because the museum was closed after the first Persian Gulf War. So it would have had to have been back in the 80s. But if you had gone in there, you might have seen the Mask of Warka, which is the first naturalistic depiction of a human face, often called the Mesopotamian Mona Lisa. You might have seen.
It's rather nice, isn't it?
It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful image. You might have seen the Vase of Warka, which is the first representation of a religious ceremony, that we have, and many, many, many other artifacts. There were 170,000 or so pieces in the museum.
Was it a popular place for Iraqis?
Yes, educationally it was important. In fact, and this is partly because Saddam Hussein used archaeology for political purposes in various ways over time to try to unite the Iraqi populace. When he needed the support from the Shiites in the south, where Sumeria had been organized originally, he would emphasize Sumeria and Sumer, and when he needed the help from people in the north, he would emphasize Assyria. But in general, he lavished the archaeological community with funds. He restored Babylon, although into something like a Disneyland version of what it originally would have been. He, in fact, had, when he discovered that Nebuchadnezzar had his name inscribed on the bricks that were in the walls at Babylon originally, Saddam ordered that the walls there be inscribed with his name.
That's such a modest chap. He was very keen on this collection, and he liked the idea of sort of connecting himself back to the glory days. And you say it was very much part of a cult of personality. I didn't know that he emptied out the Kuwait Museum during that earlier war when Iraq invaded Kuwait, but actually returned the collection to Kuwait after being driven out. He never struck me as someone with a particularly artistic sensibility.
Well, let's be clear. The evacuation of the Kuwait Museum was done by the professionals in the State Board of Antiquities and Heritage in Iraq. And while Saddam cared about artifacts, he wasn't out to pillage them and decorate his own apartment with them. So there was a very highly professionalized group of experts that worked at the Antiquities Ministry there, and when Iraq invaded Kuwait, and then the United States announced that it was going to drive them out, it was actually an appropriate thing to do to try to protect the holdings of the Kuwait Museum. So they packed them up and they moved them back to Baghdad, and when they returned them to Kuwait, the Kuwaitis were surprised to discover there was more in the boxes than they had thought had been taken.
Right.
So they did a very, very fine job of taking care of these materials.
Amazing. Back to the Iraq National Museum, who did the looting? Are we talking about art students, professional black marketeers, yobbos?
There were several different kinds of looters. First, there were the people that were just passing by and saw the chance to smash and grab, and those people just smashed the display cases, most of which had been emptied before the war. But there were some duplicates that were left over, and they took those. There were other people, Iraqi citizens, who saw the looting going on and went into the museum to try to save things, and from the hoards and brought those back later. There was a third group, however, which was clearly made up of professional thieves who very likely had cased the museum beforehand and who were and knew what they were after. They bypassed the main galleries, which were pretty much empty, went straight to a wall that had been hastily built to cover a door, broke the wall down, broke the door down, went down to the basement, had some keys which somebody had given them, went into the storerooms in the basement, made their way to the place where the most valuable artifacts were, and took many of those.
You're very scolding in your book about the U.S. administration and the fact that it didn't protect the collection. But, I mean, after all, they were fighting a war.
True enough. However, when one makes plans to invade a country, one would expect that those plans would include provisions to secure and protect the cultural sites and museums in the country being invaded.
Yes, it's always struck me as very unusual that there are these little politenesses that attend to bombing. Should there have been what?
Those are not politenesses. It's important not to destroy things when you're fighting a war. And in fact, you know, the international law after World War II was created in part to put into writing and formalize the understanding that it's important for armies not to destroy important sites when in the midst of armed conflict.
No, we just destroy people instead. You're listening to Artworks on ABC Radio National. It's Michael Gerr here with you, and I'm speaking with Lawrence Rothfield about a book he's written called The Rape of Mesopotamia. It's about the looting that happened just after the invasion of Iraq, of Iraq's National Museum.
Everyone is angry. Why the American troops not protect the museum?
The Americans weren't doing anything. They would sit at certain intersections, but they wouldn't actually get out of the Humvees or out of the tanks and really do much.
We're a platoon of Marines. I mean, we could certainly stop looting if that was our assigned task.
I picked up a newspaper today, and I couldn't believe it. I read 8 headlines that talked about chaos, violence, unrest, and it just was henny penny, the sky is falling.
We waited there for about 4 hours till we met a colonel there. And at that day, he promised that he will send armored cars to protect what's left from the museum. 3 days ago, till now, nobody came.
To try to lay off the fact of that unfortunate activity on a defect in a war plan, it strikes me as a stretch.
Were you urged specifically by scholars and others about the danger to that museum, and weren't you urged to provide a greater level of protection and security in the initial phases of the operation?
Not to my knowledge.
The greatest mystery of post-war Iraq involves that month or so after the fall of Baghdad of why the U.S. didn't do anything to control the looting, because in a way, everything that's been a problem since then started in that first month.
Think what's happened in our cities when we've had riots and problems and looting. Stuff happens.
Donald Rumsfeld said very memorably after the looting of the museum that, quote, stuff happens, end quote. What could the U.S. have done differently?
To begin with, what they should have done is to have organized a specific unit whose job it would have been to secure and protect the most important sites. Unfortunately, the U.S. military did not and does not have a standing unit whose job it is to deal with policing of cultural sites. That's part of a more general problem with the U.S. military, which is that we didn't have post-war policing capabilities at all, mainly because we devolved that to our European allies. Or that was part of a long-term military posture, developed during the Cold War. Well, so we just didn't have the kinds of policing forces that the Italians, for example, had with the Carabinieri.
What was UNESCO, the UN's cultural body, what on earth were they up to at this point?
Again, the UNESCO deals on a government-by-government government-to-government basis, so they're limited in what they were allowed to do. They tried, however, to get the attention of the U.S. and were basically given the cold shoulder. There's no love lost between the Bush administration and the United Nations in general. So
I think we've gathered that. Yes, where did all the looted artifacts go? I mean, are they sitting on Manhattan mantelpieces? Are they filling that lounge room niche in Vienna or Beijing or Adelaide or somewhere?
Well, not too many of them have shown up, but some of them have. We know that there were pieces that were recovered from in New York and Philadelphia. In Switzerland, in Peru, there was one piece that was discovered by an archaeologist who had actually excavated it. She happened to be watching Lebanese TV, a House Beautiful show, and they were panning across the living room of an interior decorator or a millionaire who had his living room decorated, and she saw a 2,000-year-old head that she had excavated on his mantelpiece.
You're kidding.
That was a wonderful recovery, actually.
That's amazing.
But most of the pieces, I think, are probably still in the Middle East,
right.
Either in storerooms or in the back, you know, the living rooms of princes in the Emirates.
Right. Can you understand that people might be less than sympathetic to the looting, given that it was done by Iraqis? I mean, it wasn't American soldiers making off with armfuls of artifacts, or was it?
Well, there were some small-scale, small cases of a few American soldiers doing that. But what we're talking about here is industrial-scale looting. We're talking about people showing up, hundreds of people with backhoes on flatbed trucks, accompanied by men with AK-47s, setting up in the evening with people selling them, food and drink so they can work all night long, and digging up, you know, thousands of hectares of archaeological sites.
But the Defense Secretary of the U.S. at the time, Donald Rumsfeld, he didn't believe that there was a lot of them. He just thought it was one person being repeatedly shown on TV. Can you read me what Donald Rumsfeld said when he was asked about the looting?
Well, Rumsfeld was asked about this at a press conference on April 11th, and his response was, and this is a quote, "The images you're seeing on television, you're seeing over and over.
And it's the same picture of some person walking out of some building with a vase. And you think, my goodness, were there that many vases? Is it possible that there were that many vases in the whole country?"
It's amazing, isn't it? Tell me a little bit about the story of a guy called William Polk. And this is someone, he travelled to Iraq on a private mission just before the invasion. Who was he and what did he actually hope to achieve?
Well, Polk is a foreign policy expert, but also connected to the museum world and to a foundation. So when he grasped the fact that there was little likelihood that the war was not going to happen, he took it on himself to try, in a last-ditch effort, to go over to the Middle East and persuade the Iraqis to allow the contents of the museum to be moved to Jordan. So he managed to get the Jordanians to agree to take the stuff if the Iraqis would agree. So then he went to Baghdad and had an interview with Tariq Aziz, who was the foreign minister, and Tariq Aziz basically said, "I have more important things to think about than this," and brushed him off.
You're listening to Radio National Artworks. Michael Gurr with you, and I'm talking to Lawrence Rothfield about his book, The Rape of Mesopotamia, about the looting of the National Museum in Iraq, just straight after the invasion. Where are we now? What's the current state of the museum in Baghdad?
The museum is actually been turned into a kind of Potemkin museum, I'd say. It's been opened.
What does that mean?
It's officially open, but in fact, it's only open to journalists and VIPs. Since 2003, it's been open three times. The first for Paul Bremer in July of 2003. Then again, at the end of 2008, for a press conference held by Ahmed Shalabi, the man who, more than anybody else, probably is responsible for us going into war by feeding false information. Chalabi
Just remind us who he was.
Yeah, he was an Iraqi who who fed false intelligence to the CIA and to Cheney and Rumsfeld, and was thought by them to be the person who would take over Iraq after the war. But it turned out that he's actually much closer to Iran than to Iraq.
Oops.
So not a very nice man, but he was allowed to take over the museum, to open it up for a day, to have a press conference at which he proudly announced that his friends had found several hundred artifacts that they were going to give back to the museum.
Oh, they just found them in their lounge rooms, I suppose, yeah.
As of 2008, yeah. And then Maliki opened it in February of 2009. But it's really not open.
Yeah. Is there an international body chasing down the missing artifacts? Is there a concerted effort happening?
Well, Interpol and customs agents over around the world are actually on alert for these things. So people are keeping their eyes open. And there is a red list of antiquities that includes photographs so people can check them. So I think there's pretty good attention being paid to, you know, noticing whether something surfaces or not. So, for example, if a few years ago somebody tried to sell a piece on eBay from a Swiss dealer, and that was stopped.
Okay. To be complete devil's advocate, is the collection actually safer out of Iraq? Did the looters do the world a favor?
I think that would be a terrible line to take. The museum is, can be protected, is more or less being protected. It's also possible, however, that taking the truly devil's advocate stance, that the country might break down, the museum might actually end up getting attacked again. The same thing is true of Afghanistan, by the way. I mean, the British just returned several tons of material that had been seized at Heathrow Airport over the last few years, but had been kept there because the Afghans didn't feel it was safe enough to bring it back. So that it's really a matter of assessing the relative insecurity of a place. And there's nothing wrong with materials being moved from one museum to another in times when security is not correct. The real problem is that much of this stuff is never going to be recovered for decades, if ever. And beyond the museum's looting, the looting of the archaeological sites.
Ah, that's right. It extended, didn't it? It actually went out to the sites.
Well, in fact, the looting on the sites is arguably many times worse than what happened at the museum. It's estimated that perhaps 100,000 to 400,000 artifacts have been ripped out of the ground between 2003 and 2006. The total holdings of the museum, which inventories everything excavated since 1924 until 2003, was only 170,000 items. So you get a sense of the scale of the looting.
Brave little looters in a country littered with roadside bombs, I would have thought. Have you been?
No.
Do you want
to?
We
tried to hold a meeting a couple of years ago as I was gathering information for this book, and the hotel actually in Jordan that we were supposed to go to was bombed. So my wife has told me I'm not allowed to try to do that again.
Okay, and fair enough too. I hope sometime in the future you do get to see this museum, which you obviously care deeply about. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lawrence Rothfield, caring from a distance. His book, The Rape of Mesopotamia, details the looting of the National Museum of Iraq. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. And for this artworks feature, the playwright and author Michael Gurr was speaking with Lawrence Rothfield. This is ABC Radio National. I'm Amanda Smith. And if you want to let a friend know about this conversation, or you want to hear it all over again yourself, well, you can listen online and you can subscribe to our podcast, abc.net.au/rn/artworks.